This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Iggy Pop, has been called the godfather of punk. Many of the punk bands of the 70s picked up on what Iggy Pop and his band The Stooges started doing in Detroit in 1967. In 1977, music critic John Rockwell wrote, "Rock and roll is full of wild men toying with the limits of the possible or the permissible. In many ways, the farthest out of them all was Iggy Pop," unquote. As for Iggy Pop's music, in 1970, music critic Robert Krysgar wrote, "I regret all the times I've ever used words like power and energy to describe rock and roll, because this is what such rhetoric should have been saved for." After the Stooges broke up in the early 70s, Iggy Pop launched a solo career that is still going strong. He recently reunited with the remaining Stooges, and they've been performing and recording. Now there's a new 2-CD Iggy Pop anthology spanning 1969 to 2003, featuring his recordings with the Stooges and his solo work. The collection includes this now famous track from the Stooges' first album, recorded in 1969, "I Wanna Be Your Dog." Iggy Pop, welcome to Fresh Air. Are those sleigh bells on the record?
Those are sleigh bells, the jazz instrument. You know, I was a drummer and percussionist before I was a vocalist. So, and I always liked jazz music, and so I was keen to use something to give the song a certain sense of space. Huh. And yeah, the sleigh bells sound, you know, they resound in a certain way, baby.
Now, you are now considered basically the godfather of punk. Did you think of yourself as being ahead of your time, or just as like being different when you started to perform with the Stooges?
You better be different if you want to make any sort of lasting impression, I think. So there was some conscious effort to stand out. I didn't think there was a big future in sort of wearing a bowl haircut and a little polyester shirt and imitating the Yardbirds or something. So we were trying to do something fresh. And then the timeliness issue, that's tricky. I still don't know what the real meaning of that phrase, "it's ahead of your time," is.
In this case, the sound that you were creating was inspired
right.
A lot of other bands. A lot of bands.
I would have to say the rest of the world was behind its effing time, is what I would say. Mm-hmm. We were, as far as I was concerned, where things should be, in for us anyway. Given what talent we had to make the sounds, these were the sounds that were suggested to me by the architecture of the time, the ideas of the time, the social quakes of that time, things like that, and the musical history, the automotive design, all that suggested this music, and also a lot of this was the next logical step of the best current music being done at that time, as far as I was concerned.
Well, how did the ideas of the time shape the music in the sense that, you know, we're talking 1969, your first album, and, you know, for a lot of people, this is the era of, say, like, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, or the Grateful Dead, or the Jefferson Airplane,
really,
right?
That was just all the phony. That shit was all phony as a $3 bill, really. And all those people were they were talking one thing and living another. You know, these. You must have noticed they all got fat really quickly physically, and there's a reason for that. It's visual. It was a visual sign of their incredible corruption, you know. And I mean, in the case of the Airplane, they went all the way from White Rabbit to We Built This City on Rock and Roll. It was just this crappy song, you know. But
Iggy Pop is never going to get fat. No one's going to accuse you of being fat.
Well, you know, but there was all that going on. And basically, I think Meet the New Boss, same as the old boss, and Won't Get Fooled Again by Pete Townsend sums it up in a certain way. But there was a new bunch that was going to organize the disaffected youth and be a new group of leaders for us. And we came along, my band and I came along at just a couple years behind these people and just thought, gee, do they suck? You know, to put it in an inarticulate, inchoate way, but to get more articulate about it, the musical goods were swinging less and less, and there was more and more artifice built without a good foundation, which is why it didn't really make you feel very good. It just sounded really impressive, and then the promises made weren't really going to be kept at any power level in the society. If I turned on the radio, if I turned on AM radio, I had to wait for 39 Leslie Gore songs to hear one good Beatles song, right? I turned on the FM radio, I had to hear some guy who's, you know, acting really, you know, like really like he was a really cool guy, and we're going to play Mr. Fantasy again by Traffic, you know. Dig the flute on this, you know. And it's just so awful and boring, and, you know, you had this crappy, and then everybody jumped on the bandwagon. So you had this pathetic song by a group called the Chambers Brothers, who were, you know, a likable black singing group who decided we got to get in on this psychedelic thing. So they had a song called The Time, and it was, you know, my mind has been psychedelicized, and it's just a lot of, you know, crap. And then professional songwriters, of course, who not to be left behind in the Brill Building, you know, the same guys who used to write, it's my party and I'll cry if I want to. Then they had to get in on the act, and they're writing songs like My Green Tambourine. You can play on the thing if you want, on this show if you want to illustrate my point, you know.
Your music was kind of extreme in the sense of, you know, it was loud. You were an extreme performer on stage. What impact did you want your performances to have on audiences?
You need to shake them up enough so that they, by the time you leave, they'll remember. Basically, and you want to make a memorable impression. Aside from that, what sort doesn't really matter, frankly. Whatever works just doesn't matter. Whatever works and whatever takes place, and that's going to change from time to time. And a lot of that's going to depend on them, and they will tend to bring that to the party, especially if you leave the door open for them. As far as us being loud, we weren't any louder. There were all sorts of people being loud, but We weren't cuddly loud. Mm-hmm. We were disturbing. The music was disturbing. It disturbed, and it especially disturbed people that thought they understood what you had to be able to do to have a license to do this stuff in public, because we couldn't do that.
Right, because you weren't, like, technically proficient. Is that what you mean?
We couldn't play Johnny B. Good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we didn't learn that technique. We learned other techniques, but, you know, there were other things we could do, but not everybody picked up on that. And then I kind of had a, you know, I don't know, something about me just generally pissed certain people off, but not other people.
Well, let's get to a little bit of what you did on stage. I mean, some of the things you've done on stage is cut yourself with glass, pour hot wax on your body. Do I have that right?
Yeah, but it took, you know, I mean, it wasn't like I went out on Friday and cut myself with glass, and then I went out on Saturday and cut my, you know, poured hot wax on my body. Those things happen. Those two incidents happened once each, and it was 4 years between them, you know. So, but after you've, you know, since I was born in 1783 and freed the slaves and, you know, learned to read by candlelight in a log cabin and introduced the electric guitar, I've had a long time to compile a huge list of these atrocities.
Why would you want to do something like that, though, like cut yourself with glass?
Well, that just happened. It wasn't really planned. It just kind of happened. One would better ask the promoter of that show why he chose to serve cocktails in glass tumblers at a very, very hard rock show.
Okay.
You know, it was hazardous, and things just happen. So there's a combination of things happen. The thing that was probably most outrageous about it was I didn't stop singing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
mm-hmm.
there was blood. I didn't go, "Oh, I've cut myself with glass. I must run now. Do buy my greatest hits." You know.
One of the things you've done on stage is dive into the audience. Which I think a lot of other people copied over the years.
Yeah, the first time I did that, it was just I was opening for the Mothers of Invention. It was the second show we'd ever played. I'd played with the Stooges it was the first one I did as a front vocalist. I'd set down the guitar and I was, you know, just front the band, and I was terrified, and I was looking for a way to get a certain kind of attention and make something happen. There was a gap between myself and the audience, a physical gap. It was too wide, and I wanted it to close. And there were only a couple of girls came and got very near the stage, but that was it. No other takers. So I thought, well, it'd be cool if I fell on them. And I did what little kids do. I don't know if you got kids, but they go through a phase, I think they're about 3 or 4, maybe 5 or 6, where they'll stand very rigid and sort of mime falling on the floor,
mm-hmm.
falling on their face. I did that, and they didn't catch me. So I had chipped a tooth pretty badly on that gig, but... that began some of my fascination with crossing the proscenium. It wasn't long after that I had a pair of jeans that I really, really liked, and I didn't want to stop wearing them at gigs, and they started getting rips and slits and holes, and nobody else was doing that either. Nobody even walked down the street with holes in their pants, and now I see every little hairdresser in L.A. walking around with slid-up pants, and Michael Jackson, and it's incredible. I got that, basically that fashion from, it was a reverse of what R&B singers used to do. P.J. Proby was famous for this. They would wear pants that were very, very thin lightly basted instead of well sewn, and they go out on stage, and when they do an acrobatic split or something, the pants would rip open, and it was supposed to be a, you know, a sexually charged event in the show. So I just thought, well, why not just come out with them already? let's just drop the ceremony here, you know.
Well, you hardly
come
came out
with a ripped pants, you know.
You've come out with hardly any clothes to begin with. I mean, you rarely wear anything on your chest. You're usually like bare chested.
They all say something. Everything you wear says something. And I just felt that what everything was saying was getting in the way. If you wear a T-shirt that says, free Katie Holmes, you're saying something. You know? You wear a blue Oxford shirt, you're saying something.
But of course, if you're bare-chested, you're saying something, too. You can't get away from it.
Well, but it can mean a lot of things. It can mean a lot of things. It's a little more basic. I got a lot of ideas for the Stooges in the undergrad library of the University of Michigan. I still had my library card. I was a college dropout, and I thought, well, this is going to take some thought. You know, there are a lot of good books in here. I used to go there and read a lot of Social Ant, which gave me a lot of ideas about behavior, tribal behavior, and its possible application to rock shows. But I was also just looking at a book of Egyptian antiquity one day, and all the pharaohs never wear shirts. And I just kept looking, and I thought, gee, you know, there's something about that. There's something expressive. Now, it's not going to work, if you're a big fat guy with a hairy chest, then that's different. But if you have I was lucky enough I had a sort of a basically normal, you know, I thought, hey, I can do Pharaoh. Yeah, you know.
But you have a very interesting body. I mean, like your arms, at least nowadays, it looks like you've been working out. Your arms look pretty pumped up. But your chest is like so thin and always has been. And so you see like every rib and sometimes even like blood vessels you can see.
Yeah, funny boy.
Yeah, so I mean, it's like it's an interesting and very skinny body.
I don't pump, by the way.
You don't?
No,
how'd you get the muscles?
For the record, I do something. I like to go swimming a lot,
uh-huh.
And I have a lot of sex, and I do something related to Tai Chi called Qigong.
Why don't we hear another track from the anthology? And I thought we could play something from Raw Power. And there's two things I can't make up my mind between these two, so I'm going to let you decide. We can either hear Gimme Danger or Raw Power. What do you think?
I would take Gimme Danger.
Okay. And why are you choosing it?
It's a little more musically complex.
Okay. Do you want to say anything about writing
just
it?
Just as a muso, I just like that one a little better. The conceit in the title is just taken from the Stones had a song called Gimme Shelter. And the theme of the song being, you know, there are all sorts of turbulent and dangerous things going on, and maybe some existential loneliness and angst of the modern hero, that sort of thing. And I was looking at the life that myself and my band at that time were barely leading, and I thought, basically, we're looking for trouble and we've got it. And I understood that, but I thought I could forestall the ticking of the clock long enough to make a nice work of art. So basically this song fit into that. That was the general theme of that album, was being Raw Power, was being in the service of some very basic and powerful forces to your eventual detriment. And you know, it's leading in a very destructive direction eventually. And then this particular one is about basically it's saying in a very elaborate way, I go for really bad chicks. that's the basic that's the basic thing of the song. You know? So it's, okay. Hey, if you're really a bad chick, you know, you're probably my type, baby. That's the deal.
So when you say "and I'll feel your disease," are you referring to VD?
Well, no, not necessarily. Okay. Just
whatever you got.
Whatever's wrong. Whatever's okay. Wrong. Yeah.
All right. So this is "Give Me Danger," originally from the Iggy and the Stooges album Raw Power, and it's now included on the new Iggy Pop anthology, which is called "A Million in Prizes." You were saying before we heard that you and your band at the time were looking for trouble and finding it. You talked about being under the sway of powerful forces. Were you talking at all there about drugs?
Well, yeah, the drugs came into it as they're really, those are enablers of deeper things usually. So basically we were a bunch of guys who somewhere along the line, in one way or another, each of us, what we had in common was each of us had put a foot out of line and we weren't going along with the quote unquote the program. And then once you put one foot out of line and you're not going along with the program, it's really easy to put the second foot out of line and then you're not going along with two programs. And then the next thing you know, you're so far out there, if you look over your shoulder, you realize, oh gee, I'm not included in any program. and that then becomes, you know, there's no life. That's not a prescription for living. And within that vacuum, all sorts of terrible things can happen to a person. And of course, just to support the angst and the bitterness that comes with that sort of a position, drugs become more attractive than they should be. But we did try to do one thing.
Yeah.
There was one thing that we could manage to do, and we managed to get together and form a band and make this music. And that was really the only respectable thing any of these people were able to do, and that was what we all had in common. Everything else, I was the conservative member in the group, so I would at least pay lip service once in a while to, you know, whatever. The rest of them were just basically laughing at existence.
When you were doing drugs, and I think you basically tried everything, and, you know, heroin, cocaine, MDA, which later became known as ecstasy, and so on, did it bring out or subdue parts of your personality, particularly as a performer? Do you feel that any of your stage persona developed in part as a result of the drugs, or did you have inhibitions that were diminished as a result of drugs? How did it play into who you became as Iggy Pop?
Yeah, I think it would slightly, in general, it would slightly release inhibitions, but not so terribly much. There would be a slight encouragement to be a bit more of an exhibitionist,
mm-hmm.
and a very great central encouragement on most drugs. In other words, just feeling good for no particular reason, you know, whether it was, you know, whether it would enhance sex or enhance the ability to appreciate the beauty of a leaf shimmering in the breeze on a summer day, that sort of thing, or the beauty of a piece of music, what have you, the beauty of even a favorable emotion directed at you from another person. But I thought what it really did, the really pronounced effect it had on me, all of them had in common, was to shut out all sorts of things. And that kind of was really helpful at certain times when you're trying to make something creative. There are all sorts of voices within and without you that are going to say, no, it's not worth doing. No, it will never get finished correctly. No, it's no good. No, nobody will like it. No, it's not worth thinking about. No, it would be more fun or more profitable to go do X, Y, and Z instead of sticking on plan A, that sort of thing. Drugs were pretty good for shutting out a lot of the naysay in existence, at least for me, for a while. And then basically my experience was that little by little they rocked and socked my nervous system too much to be worth the trouble. And then finally, as a tide recedes late in the day, all the possible positives just seem to disappear, and you're just left with the hideous negatives.
Right.
That's kind of how it went for me.
Mm-hmm. And you did the
whole thing. You're sort of like, I could compare it, if I could compare my body to a neighborhood, a really nice neighborhood that everybody suddenly becomes popular and it quickly becomes overdeveloped. That's sort of like basically the drugs begin to build condos all over your body until you don't want to live there anymore. Kind of like that, you know.
I want to ask you a little bit about, like, your high school days. I was reading an essay about you by the British writer Nick Kent, and you said to him, "I was transformed into a dork in high school when I first became exposed to the incredible cruelty that children have at their disposal, and there's nobody more equipped or inclined toward cruelty than upper-middle-class children whose folks have lots of money and big cars. Whenever I tried to express myself, I'd be laughed at. I was considered weird, the weird kid. I was also very shy, very unhip, very unglib, and never wore the right clothes. I also had very weird looks because my father, being a military man, forced a military haircut on me."
That sums it up pretty well.
So you still think of yourself as having been pretty dorky in high school?
To that side, yeah. I was more to that side than was the optimum school position, yeah, certainly. But there are a lot of people who had it worse than me. You know, I think we had a hermaphrodite, a guy with a club foot. You know, cross-eyed. There were definitely, you could go. We had beatniks. They call them stoners now. You know, that there were. You could go farther in the alien direction, but yeah, I have my problems with it, and I think in general the country keeps wanting to revert to a certain Anglo-Saxon country clubism, and it keeps reinventing that theme. You're seeing it right now, and that sort of lurks somewhere behind the celebrity of the Hilton family.
Another thing you told Nick Kent is that Nico, who sang for a while with the Velvet Underground, gave you some advice when you were still basically a skinny kid and starting to perform. What kind of advice did she give you?
Well, it was very very feminine, but you know, in that it would be something as banal as how to wear your hair. But it was very serious about it. "You are Jimmy. You are not meant for your face to be seen. You must wear the hair to hide your face. Your face, you only look good this way," you know, sort of thing. And then I think she gave me some sexual instruction. And it was more, the best thing about her is that she's a hell of an artist in spurts. And I just listened to Desert Shore the other night, one of her albums, and she's good. And then she was just incredibly much more combative than me, and really brought that out in me. That short time we spent together, she actually followed me to Michigan and lived in our band house for a few weeks, much to the delight and much to the mirth the rest of the band. This very, very strange German bohemian girl about 10 years older than all of us wandering around the house speaking in a thickly accented baritone. But she was cool. Some of the music is just fabulous. It's wonderful. What a great artist.
You'd said that one of the things she told you was that you're not full of the poison. And that we don't want to see a person on the stage. We want to see a performance. And poison is the essence of the performer. What did you interpret that as meaning? And did you do anything with that advice?
Chicks are twisted. They don't like nice guys.
That's what you think it means?
That's what it means, yeah. It's just a fancy way of saying that. Don't be human.
Don't be human.
Don't be human.
Did you try to not be human on stage?
No, it's just somebody's talking while you're around. You know, I think she just made me drink a lot more. So you know, I tended to get in more trouble. More trouble came up when she was around. But it's always convenient to have somebody to blame those things on. You know,
part of the punk aesthetic that you helped create was the sense of, like, you don't have to be technically proficient to make a great record or to do a great song or give a great performance. Is that a guitar I hear?
Oh, no, it's part of a microphone stand.
Oh, okay.
I'm moving around in here.
Okay.
I got tired of sitting down.
I thought
so
you were
going
to break into song for a second.
Yeah, no. Well, when I was a little kid, I used to strum on things just like this around the house. Yeah, I used to play with all sorts of appliances.
I mean, that's great. What are you strumming now?
It's a piece of coiled wire that acts as a spring to allow the microphone stand to be put in any position. It's a kind of leverage spring.
Right, I got one here, too.
Yeah, I'll bet you do.
Mine doesn't play as well as yours.
Well, you see, that's why.
You're a better musician than I am. So you were really just, like, interested in, I mean, it's what the avant-gardists would call, like, music concrete, you know, just, like, profound sounds.
I was interested in all that, yeah.
So, I mean, did you know that part of what you were doing was actually very avant-garde and that there was a long kind of, like, classical avant-garde, you know, intellectual tradition of the kind of thing that you were translating into punk?
Being a young American, I didn't know the long version. I knew the short version, though. So I was aware of Harry Parch. I was aware of John Cage. I was aware of, you know, a little Buddha, a little Satan, a little, you know. Hey, who's around, you know? A little Balinese gamelan, you know. A little Tuareg medicine song. And, you know, also a little... na 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 by Cannibal and the Headhunters, you know. So, you know, I was aware.
You've said that among your favorite recordings are Frank Sinatra's In the Wee Small Hours.
Yeah.
And did you ever want to sing that way? Did you ever wish you could?
I can and do, and I have. There's one, I think there's a show tune on this anthology. Well,
sure, there's a Cole Porter song.
Yeah. I mean, I use things from that school, those several schools of songwriting. Sometimes I can put in a lyric. There's a song called Corruption on the anthology here, the lyric goes from the. I don't know, but I use a repetitive phrase that I also took from Night and Day by Cole Porter. So, yeah, I can sing that stuff. I do it somewhat, you know. And I can talk a song if that's what's needed. There are some things I can't do. I can't carry a melody to all the way to tea with the Queen, but I can put it in a basket and get it across the street for you. So that's about how good I am, you know. I can't scream a hard rock blues or a heavy metal lick, but I can manage to squirt out a thrashing, annoying sound. So, you know, everybody has things they can do.
Do you think of Iggy Pop as being like a stage persona, and are you still Jim Osterberg offstage?
Well, that used to be the case, but not anymore, is I've been Iggy Pop longer than I was just Jim Osterberg. Mm-hmm. So things have changed. It's been, I started being me when I was, I don't know how many years old, 21, something like that. And that was 37 years ago. So I was only without me for about 20 years.
Was that how you felt when you created like Iggy Pop, that you had figured out who you really were? That was who you really were?
No, I was just like I gained the services of an extra person. Actually, you know, as Iggy Pop, there are all sorts of things I can do and receive and be that were not happening for Jim Osterberg. And then I have a great deal of pleasure being Jim Osterberg, and I have just a really lovely private existence that way. And Iggy does a lot for me.
What does Iggy do for you?
Well, he pays, for one thing. And very well, I might add. He saves me all sorts of social necessities, you know, because he's known. He gets me a good table.
In the 70s and in the 80s, did you expect that you were going to die young?
No. No. I never even, I don't know about you, but you don't think about those sort of thing until you hit 50-something, you know, and then little voice starts saying, hey, guess what? Guess what? You know what the next phase is, don't you? That's right. Ciao, bunny bunny. What are you going to do with the time anyway? Sort of thing.
Well, if you're hearing that voice, is that changing anything for you?
Yeah, you think about all sorts of things. It makes you a little more mellow about some of the little everyday human encounters. A little more, not much. And then otherwise probably makes a little more careful. And other than that, it's sort of like if I looked at the arc of my life emotionally, I'd say that the last part's starting to resemble the first part, in that the first 7 years, I feel that I'm in the seventh 7 year cycle of my profession. I am professionally in that. I thought about this the other day. I started in the early mid 60s. I got my union card, and pretty much my life's gone in 7 year cycles, and this is the seventh now. I'm about a year into it, and this is the last one. When I finish this one, I'll be 65, and that's that's about as old as you can get and not be forced to kind of shift your professional outlook, I think, to second base at that point. But right now I'm still a loaded gun. And on the first seven and the last seven, each seemed to be based on a lot of thought about, okay, what do I really want to do here, and how can I do it to the best of my ability? And then, of course, how can I fend off anybody who isn't going along with that?
No.
Which involves just all sorts of buddies.
Now that you have this.
Then, of course, you enjoy support. I get a lot more support now than I did during the first 7 years, which is great, because when you're an old git, you need it. So I've got money now that I need money. You know, I'll have a little bit of, you know, a little bit of attention. I need it, you know, because it's harder to break through the papier-mâché at this point.
How do you feel about your body of work? It's, you know, a lot of it is collected on these two CDs, this new anthology. There's other work that's being released by Rhino Records in August. So it's a good time for you. I don't know if you've been doing this, but it's a good time to kind of take stock of your musical career. So looking back on your body of work, how do you feel about it?
I got a copy of everything on CD, and I took them around the house, and I do things like, first I arranged them in one big pile, like an apartment building, and then I laid them all out next to each other in different formations on the rug, and then I tried two or three piles. You can make pyramids. You can do all these different things, and there they are. Oh, look at those CDs. The first thing that kept, you know, a little voice kept saying, so shut up now for a while. That was the first thing. Just shut up. Look at all this stuff. Shut up. You know, give it a break for a little while. So that was interesting. Although I've been writing with my first band, the Stooges, and we've got a bunch of stuff. So maybe I can manage to record that and then shut up. I don't know. That was one thought, and then otherwise one has impressions, and they vary from day to day. Some of the more obscure, there's one called Zombie Birdhouse that hardly anybody knows. It's fairly obscure, but I listened to that the other day. I really liked it more than I thought I would, because I was pretty well alcoholic when I made that, and I thought, oh God, the vocals are going to suck, but they're not so bad. Although every once in a while I'll hear a part and think, gee, you could have done that better, but you know, given what it was, I feel a lot of different things. So in some sense, you sort of look at all this, at them, and say, hey, cool, I managed to make you and get you out, and I managed to get you back in print. And somebody's checking you out. They're like little friends, you know. They really are, all the songs. So those are some of the feelings.
Well, Iggy Pop, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Hey, you too, Terry.
Iggy Pop has a new anthology featuring two CDs of his recordings with the Stooges and his solo work, and a DVD of a 1999 performance. It's called A Million in Prizes.